Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is award-winning writer, director, documentary filmmaker, and producer, Priyanka Kumar. And tonight, we're going to be talking about her novel, Take Wing and Fly Here. Priyanka, it's so great to talk to you again.
It's my pleasure, Mark.
Whatever. I know the answer to this, having read your memoir, but whatever made you push you over the edge to write a novel about people in the birding community and those that love them that aren't?
You know, Mark, I was, as you can probably tell by now, after, you know, reading both Conversations with Birds and the novel Take Wing and Fly Here, I've been involved in birds and the birding world for a really long time, well over two decades. And although I would say that now I think I primarily bird alone or with my family, when I started out, I was not only birding by myself, but I was also birding in big groups. And I was doing this for several years until I realized that at some level, you know, at a primary level, of course, I was birding, but at a secondary level, as an artist, as a filmmaker and an author, this was kind of great grounds for a sociological study, if you have it.
I'm embarrassed to say you're obviously correct.
And I mean, there was just such a interesting. There were so many interesting ways in which these birders from different walks of life and different age groups were interacting with each other. And keep in mind, this was in a time, you know, when I started writing this book, this was before social media and other tech stuff had taken over our lives. So I think that people were actually talking to each other more and joking more and connecting more. And now when I read I reread the novel for this interview, and I really felt like I had captured this slice of time before technology took over our lives.
And, you know, you're really correct about that. And it's funny because I also birded. I've been birding for about 45 years. And there was a time when, for instance, you got bird news on a phone, when you wanted, there was like a recorded updates about birding. There were phone trees if a rarity appeared, and people would call other people, and it was a lot more interactive. The amazing thing, it's all the obsession of birding now, with even less human interaction. It's like now all, you know, everything's, you know, you can get your eBird notification the every time a rarity appears. And people are just running all over the place.
I mean, and I think to some extent, especially rereading the novel, I felt it's a shame in terms of what we've lost.
Because
really, you know, if people had a cell phone back then, it was just like an emergency phone tucked away somewhere. But really, I was amazed to reread and see how much people were talking and just really connecting with each other in a deeper way. And to tell you the truth, I hadn't realized that at the time. At the time, when I wrote it, I was thinking that, you know, our societies are quite fragmented, and it would be great if people were more deeply connected. But now, you know, reading it 10 years later, I'm thinking, wow, we were really connected.
Maybe you could write part two, the sequel, because I'll tell you that I think that's such an interesting observation, Priyanka, because what the technological advance has made again is interaction, human person to person interaction, obsolete, and
Absolutely.
So birders don't really have to call anybody, and I think it's become even more competitive because of this. Because there are people are getting on the second notification of rarities, and people just rush out, even if it's just a mediumly interesting bird.
Right.
But let's talk about your novel, because you're right. I think that's one of the values of this book. And it really hit me hard because it's behavior that's really sort of strange. Birding can be very obsessive, as several of these people in the book are. And I concluded this is really about how birding can consume your life. This is a part of that about this book. I mean, the main character, JK,
yeah,
he he's supposed to be a physicist. and people are going to read this going, you're giving up, you're mucking around with that career just to go see a, you know, a Bell's Vireo. But that's the truth. I mean, the things I've done for birding, I'm embarrassing to talk about. I had people visiting from me out of state, and a pelican suddenly appeared, and it left a note on the door that we'd be back in about 4 hours.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in the novel, J.K. is obviously at, you know, maybe one of the most critical years in his life. He's this guy in his 20s, and he's at a critical stage, not just in his personal life, but in his professional life. He's, you know, trying to get a job in physics, which itself is a very competitive field. But his... I mean, the novel really charts how this big year obsession just entirely consumes this otherwise, you know, rational and well-meaning young man. And it consumes his life. And from my point of view, it's an affectionate portrait. I mean, this is not about in any way putting down J.K. or Rick, who's the president of the Birding Society, his main competitor. I feel like it's an affectionate portrait of all these birders, but hopefully it's an accurate portrait of what a certain type of competitive birding does to us or has the potential to do to us. And maybe the book will get people to think about, you know, possibly other ways of looking at birds.
It's fascinating how it can consume your life, especially when you get into things like big days, big years. You know, I used to really every year try to get a huge Massachusetts state list. Massachusetts is a small state compared to Southern California, which is where this takes place. And right. That would consume my life. In J.K. in the book, I mean, it ruins early on. It ruins his love life.
Yeah, I mean,
he missed dates. The woman, and you wrote about it, tolerated his craziness. And I've seen these relationships, Priyanka. I've seen these relationships between hardcore birders and a non-birder.
Right.
And, you know, if you think marrying outside your religion is tough, you cannot make that work. I don't care who you are. You cannot make that work.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, as I said to you before, I think of this novel. I mean, it's totally a work of fiction, but I do think of it as.
I was going to ask you about this. Mm-hmm. When this came out, were there people that you knew who really asked you, "Is that me?"
You know, no. I was concerned about that, you know, I mean, fortunately, at that point, I had, I really started writing this book in earnest the last year I was in California. And then after that, I spent a year in Manhattan birding in Central Park. Mm. And that was when I was, I wrote sort of the bulk of the book. I had all my notes with me. And then after that year, moved to Santa Fe, and that's when I edited the book. So at that point, I was already distanced from that world that I had been so deeply embedded in. And I think that distance did help a lot in terms of thinking of it as a work of fiction. And again, you know, while it was inspired by certain people, all the characters are really composite, and the story is my own, and a lot of the experiences, especially the birding experiences, you know, are my own. I was in those places, as you can tell when you're reading the book, I think. But you know, no, I was kind of concerned about that, and at one point when the book came out, I was getting invitations from Audubon societies all over the country, and concerned that it was going to get too close to home. And thankfully, it didn't happen. But at this point, there
were people I swear I knew. But that shows, you know, the brilliance of your writing then. We need to explain some birding terms as we go along, because we can't assume that everybody listening to this, although they should be,
right,
all birders should be listening. A big year, what is that?
So a big year is when a person undertakes a quest to see the most number of birds. And in this case, it was in L.A. County in one year, the most number of bird species. And so, you know, usually when you do that, there's a past record that looms over you. And you have this, like, insane desire to shatter that record, whatever cost to definitely your sleep, your professional and personal life, and your well-being. And there's certainly, it can offer you unparalleled thrills. And at the same time, like I pointed out, you do end up paying a steep price for it, I think.
It's amazing, because people do different levels of big ears. I mean, there are global big ears. There are ABA area big ears, which include Alaska and Canada. State big ears, like I used to do all the time. And county ones, when you get to the West, especially where there's big counties. And the book starts, it's really getting towards the end. Mm-hmm. And there's this tension that arises when you know that somebody else is doing this. When you know that somebody's hot on your trail or you're trailing them, things get extremely crazy.
They do. And in fact, what I wanted in this book, and I felt that happens on the second read, this time around, it really was, for me, I experienced the joy of reading this book, because I think previously I was way too close to it. What I wanted is for you to not necessarily root for any one character.
No.
But, I'm not taking sides. But both of these guys who are, in dead heat competition with each other, I mean, they're compelling guys. They have interesting life stories that you can empathize with. And you kind of want them to, break the record that they're so set on breaking. I don't know. Were you rooting for one or the other?
No, because I'm trying to move beyond that on a spiritual level. But maybe I was rooting for one person. I can tell you what I did feel is I felt that tension.
Okay.
It started to come back to me. It was like a junkie feeling that, yes, he's creeping up. He's going to get a bird while you're gone for your visiting your family on the East Coast. He's going to rack up those few more birds. I mean, that tension is palpable in this book. And if you're a person who's done it, that doesn't go away. So you feel that. But I mean, notice that he has to go away at a critical point in the year, as it's getting towards the end, to see the family for the holidays. And it's not a done deal that he would do it. He's like making a difficult decision to do that.
Right. Yeah. And when you're in that circumstance, it really is an excruciating decision, because, your family wants to spend, 5 days with you over the holidays.
And generally, your family thinks what you're doing is crazy.
And then, you're just going to validate the way that they think of you by not even showing up for Christmas, right?
I've done it. There's so many great characters in this book, but I think one of the wonderful things about this, about Take Wing and Fly Here, is that you really capture the sense of what it's like to be on one of these organized bird trips. They can really seem like the Bataan death march for people who are not totally into that quest for the Baird sandpiper. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, different places have different levels of intensity on the trips, but the ones that are around LA, they really wanted people who are serious birders. There was no room for amateurs on these trips.
Like, I mean, like J.K. Observes at one point that, he can easily tell apart the amateurs from the real thing because, the amateurs leave midway through his birding trip, and his birding trip almost never ends. So that's the kind of trip he prides himself on.
And I love
you get back home shattered, heart and soul.
That's right. And he survives on what? Anchovies
and boiled eggs.
Boiled eggs. Ooh.
Pickled boiled eggs.
Boiled eggs. And you know, that's close to a lot of people I know, especially British birders who are very hardcore.
Right.
They'll live minimally and rack up a big list. And usually they'll work really awful jobs for a year that'll finance a trip, a birding trip, to some other place out of the country. But these trips that are in the book really capture what it's like to be on one of these birding trips. If you're not a serious birder, it can be just brutal, especially in Southern California, where it seemed to be like hot all the time.
Right.
And people were just really wiped out, and they're at sewage ponds and stuff like that.
Right.
And so it stinks. And people who were not used to it were just tortured.
And I mean, I would like to point out that all the details about the places and the birds found are completely accurate. So if you want to plan a bird trip around this book.
That would be a great project for you to do, is to lead one of these trips that are in the book. Oh, my God.
Right.
Well, and the funny thing is he was after some very special birds that rarely appear in L.A., like a Baird sandpiper. Baird sandpiper here is fairly very uncommon to rare. It's not quite as rare as it is there, but it was just amazing. And the interesting thing is there was a young person birder in the group. And that's become much more popular than it was back then.
Is that right? I mean, maybe
there's a lot more young birders now. The ABA has created organizations specifically for young birders, and there's Young Birder Awards. And that's going on. But this was like at the time when that was a new deal.
It was a new deal.
Unfortunately, his mother, who's not a hardcore birder, was like tracking around with him. And oh, my God, did she go through the tortures of the damned?
Oh, gosh. She is really suffering. And I think, as a birder, I feel her suffering and what she's trying to do for her son. And, it's interesting to me that she evolves into this character who ultimately ends up caring about some of the deeper issues maybe some of the more hardcore birders are not exactly thinking about.
Now, there's a little interesting theme that runs through. It's an event, and that's Endangered Species Management Program, trapping cowbirds. And I witnessed that when I went to look for Kirtland's warble up in Michigan. And they were doing active, and they had the setups for trapping cowbirds because they parasitize nests. And I wanted to ask you how you felt about that, because somebody asked in the book, it's okay to kill some species but not others. That's an interesting question. That's a philosophical question that's not automatically easy to answer.
Yeah, and to tell you the truth, Mark, I've seen a lot of these cowbird traps, and I remember especially in the early days when I would come upon them, it was wrenching to see not just the cowbirds, but some of the other birds that would inadvertently get trapped.
That's
and
right.
Sometimes we're just there in the heat of day for hours at a stretch, and seeing that they actually weren't. They didn't care to eat or drink, even though, food and drink was provided, and they just wanted to get the hell out of there. You're right, it's a philosophical question. I mean, I think I lean towards not doing such heavy management.
That's a tough question. That's funny that you say that, because when I saw it, I understood the necessity of it. In the case of Kirtland's warbler, it's a severely endangered species, very local, heavily parasitized by cowbirds. They would catch them in these traps, and then what they would do is they would put them in big garbage bags and put the end of the garbage bags off of a tailpipe of a car and run the car. And I was this is what I loved about the fact that you included this in the book, because it is an interesting question. One of the reasons that cowbirds are there, as opposed into the Midwest, is because we wiped out the bison herds that they used to follow, and we've also totally decimated the forests. So we created the habitat for cowbirds. We own that. And now we're like selectively saying, okay, and it's a difficult situation. And what I just arrived at is, okay, I understand why people think it's important. I just could never do that personally.
Exactly. And I think it's important to ask, you know, are there other management strategies? I mean, and I think I tell that story in this novel, that, you know, these cupboard traps in that particular instance were being set up supposedly to help the Bell's vireo primarily.
Right.
And but at the same time, there were other management decisions being taken, like mowing the habitat in the area. And you know, the Bell's vireo does prefer longer grassy habitat, and that wasn't helping the Bell's vireo. So, you know, I think we have to question whether there are other, you know, non-invasive management strategies that could help the birds that we're trying to help, you know, without being so brutal to a bird like a cowbird.
There's another classic birding situation you have in this book, and that's a pelagic trip. And for people who have never been on a pelagic trip, I've been on pelagic trips in California, and I've never seen so many people throw up in my life. And I've been on a lot of pelagic trips on the East Coast, and it can be really dicey. Have you gone on a pelagic trip?
Oh, absolutely, I have, and it's rough. Believe me, the some of the suffering there is personal.
It was too well written for you not to have done this.
Yes, I've never been so tortured that I actually was tempted to, you know, like jump into the ocean,
which somebody does in your book.
Yes.
That's the thing I've always waited for in these pelagic trips, is they either on purpose or by accident, because everybody's crowding on one side of the boat to see the Jaeger going by or something like that. And I'm surprised I've yet to see somebody fall in the water.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite chapters in the book. And I mean, I love those trips. They're great, and it's a real thrill to experience seabirds in the ocean.
Oh yeah.
But at the same time, it can get a little crowded.
First of all, you've got a bunch of hardcore birders on a small space. It's right. Like concentrated insanity, and then there's always some person calling the birds, and then they'll call some incredible thing, and they use the clock system to point it out, which you have in the book. And then everybody's on that side of the boat, and the boat like tilts.
Right.
But somebody actually goes into the drink on purpose in your book, which is, I found, amazing.
Somebody, what?
Goes into the drink on purpose.
On purpose, right.
Oh my gosh.
Oh gosh, those pelagics. Yeah, and I don't know what it is about California pelagics that makes everybody, like you said, half the people, you know, throw up.
Some
truth to that.
They just sort of seemed used to it. Like, to me, I haven't thrown up in like 35 years, so it's a big deal for me to throw up at this point. But whenever I went into California, people are just very cash about throwing up over the side. Like, they, first of all, they knew where they should go, because you don't throw up into the wind.
Right.
That's not good. You go to the back of the boat, you go away from the wind. But they were just very cash about it. And they were also chumming with these barrelfuls of like rancid herring or something like that. So that was adding to the pleasure too. Now, on the other hand, on the upside, we saw huge numbers of great pelagic birds and fantastic sea mammals, great whales.
Oh, yeah.
I saw my first blue whale on a California pelagic.
Wow.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. But the amazing thing is your book so successfully captures all these moments.
All the tortures and joys.
Right. And if you're a birder, it's all joy. It's torches for the people who are birder adjacent, people in your family, maybe your significant other or whatever. Yeah, it was just amazing. So,
and you know, you're right, Mark. You, when we were talking earlier, you mentioned that these relationships between birders and non-birders.
Oh God!
And I've seen so many of those, and sometimes I just want to tell the non-birder, you know, just.
Well, but the thing is, Priyanka, you moved through that and into a more sane appreciation of nature, and that's told in your other book,
right?
Your memoir. And I think that, first of all, it could be an incredible thing if you have children to bring them out in nature and show them that at their pace. I think that's invaluable. But I don't think it's a great thing to bring them to birding.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a wonderful thing to move to this other phase, as you put it, Mark, and to have. I really see it as an evolution of our birding journeys, and I truly believe that you know, it's open. That evolution is open to anyone, and it's extremely gratifying to be able to. You know, love birds in maybe a more balanced way, and maybe get away from that kind of maniacal, you know, ticking off birds off lists and really appreciating ecosystems. I mean, I think I'm at now. I'm thinking about birds as bird communities and the ecosystems.
And the other creatures, you know, that are there too.
And the other wildlife that's there too. And just, you know, just looking more at just the landscapes and appreciating that and understanding more about, you know, ecosystems like the grasslands how they're being fragmented.
This is a wonderful book. Birders should read this book because it really captures it. And it's amazing. And it really is all about the other things other than birding, too, that surround the birder. We're completely out of time. And I could be talking for hours about this book. My returning guest tonight is award-winning writer, director, and documentary film producer Priyanka Kumar. And we've been talking about her novel, Take Wing and Fly Here. It is excellent. Priyanka, it's a pleasure as always.
Mark, lovely to talk to you. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.